This podcast is produced by KPP Financial Steve Peasley, President, simplifying a complex money world with investment programs to match a range of investment goals and life situations. And now today's podcast.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Invest Talk. This is our May 8th, 2017 edition of Invest Talk. And as always, we are here to help you become an above average investor. And this is our 1 hour time slot to open a dialogue about your retirement portfolio, the particular index, a particular industry, a particular asset class. And we're going to talk about how to build up your entire financial picture and your portfolio without taking more risk than you have to. Or then you should. Now, I invite your calls. Let's have some fun today. We'll talk about anything that has to do with your money, savings, investing, maybe saving it, right? You can get through right now. We'll take your call in a couple of minutes at 888-99-CHART. Once again, that's 888-992-4278. Now, Steve and I talked before about transitioning from growth to value stocks. And high-profile proponents of value investing, including Warren Buffett, have argued that the essence of value investing is buying stocks at less than what would be their intrinsic value. Now, the intrinsic value is a subjective term. That number is very, very subjective. So it's up to you to come up with what that is. But understanding the how to get to that number, at least in a general way, is very, very important. Now, the discount of the market price from that intrinsic value is what Benjamin Graham calls the margin of safety. It's that gap between what it's trading at today and what you think the intrinsic value is based on usually cash flows, earnings, balance sheets, growth, etc. All those go into the calculation and the understanding of what is the intrinsic value of a company. Now, some may use the present value of future cash flows. That's the basic definition of value of any financial asset, right? It's what am I going to get in the future? And when it comes to cash flows, think of a bond, for example, meaning future interest payments. And then you have to discount those cash flows based on some sort of market rate to today's number, right? Because you rather have less money today, right, than 5 years from now. You have to wait 5 years to get a larger amount. So say in 5 years, you're going to get $100 payment in interest. Well, you need to discount that $100 by some sort of interest rate to get to a lower value today that you would accept, right? Because you can go and invest a lower amount and get more or equal to $100 5 years from now. So it can be a little bit complex, but it's a basic concept you need to understand when it comes to investing. Now, present value is simplest of two as it required. It's only one input, really, like I said, an interest rate. And that interest rate is usually the 10-year treasury rate, but you can use other rates as well. Now, the theory behind using treasury rates to define the risk-free rate is that it's zero risk. You're not risking your principal. The higher this rate is, the less attractive other investments will be, all else being equal. And this is why when interest rates fall in the 10-year treasury rate, usually stock prices go up, bond prices go up, because now you're discounting those future cash flows by a lower rate. And that's one of the goals of the Federal Reserve when they do lower interest rates. They're trying to raise asset prices. They're trying to create that wealth effect. They're trying to create what they call animal spirits. And they say all this in their wording of why they're lowering interest rates, why they're targeting asset prices. And this is a very basic concept that you need to understand and understand what the Fed is trying to get at. Now, the Fed's raising rates. Now, what effect will that have now? For the most part, it should have an opposite effect. Should lower asset prices to a degree. Now, it hasn't done that a whole lot, but that's generally what it's supposed to do. And that's why they do it slowly, because they don't want to really destroy the market. They do it at a measured pace. Now, future cash flows are by far the most complex, because many times these numbers are merely projections, right? You can tell me what the cash flow has been over the last year, but do you know exactly what it's going to be going forward? On a bond, it's really easy. As long as they don't default, this is what the payment's going to be. On a stock, that can be up in the air. Especially when it becomes, when you're talking about companies that don't pay dividends, companies that are growth stocks, and you're trying to project out 3 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, what profits are going to be, what cash flows are going to be from the business. Now, in 99, 2000, the story of the tech sector was that they were going to have massive growth and future cash flows were going to be gigantic. Well, in reality, the expectations that were built in the market were not nearly as bright as the market had expected. And that's why you had the tech crash. And we'll have something similar here in the next few years. Probably, you know, the likes of Tesla will crash and burn into flames, like a lot of the tech names from the late 90s and 2000 did. And there'll be other names as well. A lot of them are private. They're maybe less public these days. Think of private equity firms and the Ubers of the world. And there's certainly a bubble in that area as well. So understanding future cash flows, discounting them to current values are important when you're trying to figure out the value of a stock. Now, if you can fully understand these two pillars of finance, then you will be a step ahead. Understanding the big picture is crucial to making good investment decisions. Now, do you have a question about determining value or any other money questions? Our listener line is open at 888-99-CHART. Let's check in now with our 24-hour listener line with a question that came in between programs.
Hi, Steve. Can you explain what puts and calls options trading and how would that benefit the average investor?
Well, puts and calls are derivatives. They're options. And what they are options, just like they said, option to buy or sell a particular security at a certain price in the future, at a certain and it expires on a certain date. Okay. Now, a call is the option to purchase the stock at a certain date in time at a certain price. A put is the opposite. It's the option to sell the stock at a future price or a future date at a certain price called the strike price. Now, if you're going to be bullish on a stock, you would buy a call option. If you would be bearish on a stock, you would buy a put option. Now, you can use both to hedge. For example, if you own a stock, you could sell a call at a higher price than it is today. It's called an out-of-the-money call. Get a premium, and if it goes up in value, you'll gain a little bit up until that strike price, and then beyond that, whoever owns it will make that profit, and your profit will be limited. Now, on a put, you can use it to hedge by buying a put option. And if stock price goes down dramatically, you won't lose more than the difference between today's price and the strike price that you bought the put option at. You could sell a put option if you want to buy a stock at a specific price. They're complex. So can you use them to your advantage? Absolutely. But you really need to understand the intricacies, and it's by far the area where most people get in the trouble, and they get in over their head too quickly. So if you're going to use them very diligently, very carefully, and really understand what strategy you're deploying and what you're buying, or potentially what options you're selling as well, and make sure you have your eyes 1,000% open if you're going to endeavor on that game, because it's very risky, and 85% of options expire worthless. So that's something to consider as well. I'm financial advisor Justin Klein. How about a money quip? Author and comedy writer Robert Orban said, "Every day I get up and look through the Forbes list of the richest people in America. If I'm not on there, I go to work." We're working to help you make the most of your money. Check in with your question or comment. 888-99-CHART is our live listener line every weekday from 4 to 5 Pacific time. Now, it's easier to understand an ETF's stock-like characteristics, but what about ETNs, exchange-traded notes? How to choose between an ETF and an ETN? That's one of our talking points today. Also, some others as well. We have the jobs number, the jobs figure that came out on Friday, and it actually beat expectations, 211,000 jobs created. That was above the market expectation of about 190,000 jobs that were created. However, if you look underneath the surface, it was a pretty weak report overall. And I'm going to explain to you why that is. It was really interesting to see. There's a lot of seasonality adjustments that go along with the April report. But overall, the end report was kind of weaker than that 211,000 jobs would lead on. So we're going to discuss that. And then Ponzi schemes, they are alive and well. You know, we're about a decade past the Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme, the biggest in history. And I'm going to talk about where we are currently and how many Ponzi schemes are being uncovered and how you can avoid Ponzi schemes in the future. And then finally, do you have a portfolio emergency? You may or may not. And I'm going to get into when you should ring the alarm bell, and then maybe when you should just be a little cautious and make some slight adjustments. So we're going to get to that as well. But ultimately, I want to hear from you. I want to know what's on your mind. 888-99-CHART is how to reach me. Now let's take a quick look at today's market. We had the Dow up 5 points, the S&P basically flat, up 0.09 points. NASDAQ was up 2. About as flat as day as you can think of. You did have transports down. I noticed underneath the surface there was some weakness. Transports were down 1%. That was pretty interesting to me. You had small caps down about a little less than 0.5%. Also an interesting little tidbit as well. The economic data continues to be weak, and we have some more consumer data that comes out Thursday that'll be very important to see if the consumer is bouncing back from a weak first quarter. And just overall, it's a market that's kind of going nowhere. This is Invest Talk. I'm Justin Klein. 888-99-CHART is how to reach me right now, 4 to 5 Pacific time. Any money questions are welcome. Give me a call.
Hi, this is Charu here from Fremont. I have a question. Is realty income with the stock symbol O a good investment opportunity in May 2017? I see that the stock has fallen recently, and the rising interest rates have been priced already in the stock. So I would like to hear your thoughts, Steve. Thank you for your time.
She is looking at Realty Income Corp. This is one of the largest retail REITs out there, real estate investment trusts out there. There's a $15 billion market cap, and that's after dropping from a high of $72 a share last year. Yeah, $72 a share, middle of last year, down to $55.68 at the close today. So it's certainly fallen on hard times, and a lot of it has to do with the fact, one is interest rates are rising because of the Fed, and two is retail sector is really getting smushed to a degree because of the Amazon effect that is affecting every retail space out there to some degree. And when a lot of those retail spaces are going vacant, realty income is certainly going to have some pressure on their cash flows and their rents. And the market's starting to price that in. Now it's yielding about 4.5%. And honestly, it's not there yet. It is not cheap enough for me to get that excited. It needs at least to go down to $50 a share. And I think it's probably going to go lower because of the trend in interest rates and the fact that it's not out of the realm of possibility that there's a recession in the next year or two. And that's certainly going to hit the stock. So I would not be buying realty income. I do think short-term interest rates are going to fall, and that's going to help something like realty income. But I much rather buy another type of REIT than a retail REIT in this environment with consumer spending slowing and the Amazon effect. So I would stay away from O and look elsewhere in the REIT space. Let's go to Mike in Newport Beach. How you doing, Mike?
Hi, Justin. How are you?
Doing great. What can I do for you?
I have a question about ticker symbol Teva, T-E-V-A, mm-hmm. Pharmaceutical. I've been holding that since last quarter, and it's just been on a downturn. Mm-hmm. And it's sitting at a heavy support, and they have their mm-hmm. earnings in 2 days, and I'm thinking of maybe just get out and cut my losses and put that money into Lannett, perhaps. I know they had a bad quarter as well, but I'm thinking if Teva has a bad quarter, they might be taking a 20% cut the way Lannett behaved when they missed their quarter. I just want to know if, you know, what your thoughts are on that.
I mean, we own Teva in our managed accounts, and it was in our income program for sometime last quarter, and we picked it up in our dynamic growth program as well, right around this price, about $31 a share. So we still like it. It's certainly being depressed with a lot of the other companies in the space and just the space overall, and their earnings are going to fall. So that is known, and that is expected, and we expect that. Now the question is, how much are they going to fall? If they fall, you know, just modestly, then we think the stock is very, very undervalued. Now certainly if their earnings get cut in half, that's another story. But we don't think that's the case. They do have some strong brands, and they have good management, and they're going kind of through a restructuring. And usually when companies do that, they come out the other end a lot prettier. And the market is, there's a lot of uncertainty though around that. So the bottoming process we think is definitely going to take a while, or could take a while. So you might chatter around here around the $30 to $35 level for a while. But it's not without risks as well. Like you said, could it get hit by 20%? Sure, it could. We're not expecting that. We're expecting the earnings to be better than expected. But there's risk involved. So we're holding it through earnings, and so that would be my recommendation too. But know that there's certainly risk that a Lannett type move could happen.
Okay, thank you very much.
No problem, Mike. Thanks for calling. That was Teva Pharmaceuticals, T-E-V-A. Now here's an investing term you should know. What is a majority shareholder? Now, a majority shareholder is a person or entity that owns more than 50% of a company's outstanding shares. Majority shareholder is often the founder of a company, and in the case of long-established businesses, the founder's descendants. You know, think of like the Walmart, the Waltons, right, that own Walmart. Now, by virtue of controlling more than half of the voting interest in the company, the majority shareholder has a very significant influence in the business operations and strategic direction of the company. Although not all companies have majority shareholders. Everybody could be minority, meaning nobody owns more than 50%. In fact, that's probably the case for most public companies. Now, there's some recent examples, think Facebook, Google, where these different share classes, some have voting rights, some don't. And that is to keep the voting share, majority share, into one hand so they can control the direction of the company. So that's something to consider as well. Your idea about InvestTalk is that you do some of the talking. Let's hear your money question or investing experience at 888-99-CHART.
We continue our podcast next. First, a couple of words for KPP Financial and a question from Steve. When did you last review your entire investment portfolio? Well, Steve believes this is something that should be done quarterly, every year at the very least. We're talking about looking at the complete picture. If you're just checking your statements each month and putting them back in the drawer, Steve believes that you need to take a closer look. You may be missing some opportunities or taking too much risk. Invest an hour with Steve on Skype or telephone. It's easy to schedule your hour. Start the process going. Just go to investtalk.com and click on schedule a meeting or call 888-99-CHART and follow the prompts. And now back to the podcast. Invest Talk continues on this Monday for our Tuesday Invest Talk. As a financial tool that can help achieve financial goals, long-term wealth creation, or parking funds for short-term, financing goals through mutual funds. But you can still bring up your topic for today. Call us, 888-99-CHART.
888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278. We have about 25 minutes left in the show, but it's going to go by quick. So if you're going to call in sooner rather than later. Now, what is the difference between an ETF and an ETN? Now, we know that the ETF space is kind of taking over the fund industry. And ETNs are out there, but a lot of people don't really know about them. But they are traded. A lot of people mistake an ETN for an ETF. They think they're the same thing, but they're really not. Now, in practice, they are very similar. You know, both are designed to track an underlying asset, and both often have lower expense ratios than mutual funds. And they both trade on major exchanges, just like a stock. Okay. Now, the main difference is under the hood. Now, when you invest in ETF, you are investing in a fund that holds the asset it tracks. Okay. You're investing in a fund that holds the asset it tracks. An ETN is more like a bond. It's really an unsecured debt note issued by an institution, basically saying, the institution will pay out the performance of this particular fund. Now, just like a bond, with a bond, an ETN can be held to maturity, bought or sold at will. And if the underwriter, usually it's a bank, were to go bankrupt, then the investor would actually risk total default, right? You'd become a creditor to that institution, right? So if you had a Lehman Brothers ETN, you know, sponsored ETN, and they went bankrupt back in 2008, right? You would be in line with all of the senior bondholders to get paid. Okay, so there's some risk in that as well. So you need to do some research into the credit rating of the underwriter. It's an important metric. Now, if the underwriter were to receive a credit downgrade, for instance, you would probably see some sort of impact on the price of that ETN. Now, but because an ETN doesn't buy and sell assets, when there's buy and sell trades in the open market, there's no taxes that are triggered until you sell the fund, right? Often over a year, and that could be long-term capital gains. There's also no tracking error. You know, there's 4,300 ETFs currently in the market, and they have varying levels of tracking error, which how much do they really track the underlying index, right? Because of all those transactions, they may have some tracking error. Whereas ETNs, this is backed by a bank, so the bank is contractually obligated to track that particular index or that those assets tick for tick, dollar for dollar. So there's no tracking error with an ETN, which is great. Now, the market forces will cause the fund to track the underlying investment. So it's not the fund doing the tracking, just supply and demand within the marketplace. So in a lot of ways, these funds are more efficient than ETFs because of their favorable tax treatment. As long as, you know, the sponsor doesn't go bankrupt. So you need to do some research, gain an appropriate level of understanding of them before you put them in your portfolio, but they are something you definitely should consider. Now, at the heart of a good professional relationship is always trust, and trusting that your financial advisor is looking out for you. Now, KP Financial is a registered investment advisor, and being a fiduciary since 1993 when we were founded, we are required to make the best possible decisions for our clients. And being that the principals invest their own money in the same programs as their clients, there's a little extra assurance that that will happen. Now, if you'd like to see more about the investment programs offered by KPP Financial, just go to the Investments tab on investtalk.com.
Now, our InvestTalk Insiders program is a source for up-to-the-minute news. And today, these stories are being featured. 4 tips to increase your credit score fast from CNN Money. ETFs aren't just for passive investing anymore from MoneySense. And many say India has an incredible potential, so why hasn't Warren Buffett invested? That's from CNN Money. There's plenty more where that came from. Join up, become an insider. It's free. Just go to investtalk.com, select the Invest Talk tab, and then go to Invest Talk Insiders.
Hey, Steve and Justin. This is Jake. I'm a podcast listener in Santa Monica. I'm calling you guys because I'm interested in getting some more emerging market exposure into my portfolio. Doing some research, it looks like the Iranian market seems to be one that I'm seeing a lot about as having a lot of upside potential over the next 10 years. I was wondering what you guys thought about this market, and also if you know a way to get exposure to this market. It doesn't seem like I can find any ETFs out there with exposure to Iran. A couple articles and information I read talked about having to set up an offshore account in order to gain exposure to certain restricted markets, which is completely over my head. So I just want to get your take on the idea as a whole and what you guys think about that. I'm a huge fan of the show. Thanks a lot for all you guys do, and I'll listen to you on the podcast.
Oh, that's a great call. I like where your head's at, because I do think the Iranian market is an area there where there is potential growth. They do have a pretty diverse economy, and the Iranian nuclear deal reduced sanctions on their economy. And that's certainly going to help their economy over the longer term. And things are starting to move there from what I'm hearing. The problem is the sanctions that were lifted haven't been enough to really give you a lot of opportunities to invest. You do have to set an offshore account, and that can be complex, and figuring out how to basically get your money into Iran to invest can be very, very difficult. So I understand your pain, and I do like where your head's at. I just wish I had a little bit better sense of how to do that, how to gain exposure in the market and other ETFs that are involved in. There's certainly not an Iran focused ETF, but it is something that would be great if there was one, and there'd be a lot of interest. But frankly, it's just a market that's very, very difficult to get access to, and it's just not something the average investor can do, especially at a small scale. You're gonna need a lot of money to be able to direct into maybe a large fund over there that's going to find ways to get outside capital or knows how to bring in your money. So it's hard, and I feel your pain, but I really don't have a great answer to give you when it comes to options to do that. 8899 chart is our number, 8899924278. Now, we are about a decade on from the Bernie Madoff scandal. It's the largest Ponzi scheme in history that was uncovered, $65 billion. And what's interesting is that it hasn't ended Ponzi schemes. And frankly, I don't think Ponzi schemes will ever go away completely. But it is something you need to understand and consider. Last year alone, 59 Ponzi schemes were uncovered in the U.S. with a total alleged losses of $2.37 billion. And that's according to Ponzi Tracker. Now, since 2012, an average of 65 Ponzis a year have been discovered, with a medium scheme size around $6 million. Now, both the SEC and FINRA have whistleblowing programs and complaint hotlines to help successfully unearth some of these fraudsters. And if you work for a financial advisor and you think potentially they could be defrauding their clients, you can call this hotline. Or maybe you're just an investor and you're having trouble getting your money back. And that tends to be where the red flags start. Right, and that's usually where FINRA and the SEC start getting complaints from investors saying, I invested this much money, I want some of my money back, and they won't give it back to me. And you would think that these are schemes that are only perpetrated on people that are less educated, and the answer is really, it's not true. Even highly educated people are often victims of Ponzi schemes. And people who run the Ponzi schemes are very charismatic. So it doesn't matter your socioeconomic status. Anybody is subject to this. And usually it has to do with affinity scams. It's usually people that run in your circle. Either your synagogue, or maybe your city council, or there's some sort of activity or commonality between you two that will allow them to gain your trust. And the big question is, how do you avoid these? Well, first on top of the list is promises of high returns with low risk, or suspiciously consistent returns. And really, this is common sense. Markets go up and down. No one is consistent over long periods of time. And if someone claims otherwise, they're probably lying to you. Now, you can go to FINRA's Broker Check website and do your own research there. That's going to be helpful as well. And a lot of times investors need to watch out for complex, secretive, or just plain bizarre strategies that these Ponzi schemes tend to deploy. One recent one is one that was trying to make money off ticket sales to the Broadway show Hamilton. Another offered investors a slice of securitized loans to professional athletes. And that was marketed by a former professional athlete, a New York Giants football player. And this is why investors are urged to invest with regulated entities that follow strict compliance and paperwork procedures. I know a lot of times And we try to streamline our paperwork process, and we just want digital, so that's going to be helpful as well. But the, you know, the paperwork is complex to set up accounts. And, you know, a lot of people look at that and their eyes glaze over, but in reality, that's to protect the investor. And, you know, part of me is annoyed by it, but part of me says it's good because it's very important that investors' money is protected. And I think the number one way that you can avoid a Ponzi scheme is never give your money to the advisor, right? To the investor. It's the money should be going into a third-party custodian. That's why we use TD Ameritrade, we use Fidelity. We use third-party custodians, meaning they're holding onto the money, not the advisor, not the person that's giving you the advice. That's what how Bernie Madoff stole the money. He was receiving through his own entity, not a third-party entity, his own entity, the money. So he could go and do whatever he wanted with it. And that's the number one way that you can avoid getting caught in a Ponzi scheme. Now let's get back to our 24-hour listen line and pick up another question. 888-99-CHART is our anytime number.
Hey, Hayden, I want to see what you think about ETF I'm currently investing in, a Charles Schwab Dividend, SCHD, like Delta. What do you think? Is it a good ETF to invest in? And also, can you tell me what the income dividend on that one? Like, how much would I get in 1 year in a percentage-wise? I'm so confused how to calculate the income. So if you could also explain how to calculate your income from a stock, I'd really appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, he's looking at the Schwab U.S. Dividend Equity ETF. This is a domestically focused ETF. 100% of the assets are invested in U.S. stocks. Top five are Microsoft, Home Depot, Intel, Coke, and ExxonMobil. About 5% per on down is the average there. And it's going to hold a lot of different dividend-paying stocks. And the current yield looks about 3%, little less than 3%. Low expense ratio of 0.7%. So that's good because expenses are low. But you understand that this is, a lot of people are trying to get into the market and they're trying to do it at a low risk. And they think that dividends mean low risk. Now, dividends tend to mean lower risk, but they don't mean low risk, okay? So understand that as well. This is certainly on the, it's not a bond. It's much more risky than a bond, and you're getting about 3%. Now, that could rise over time, but that could be cut as well, depending on the underlying assets in the, in the fund. So it's a good fund, but it's certainly, I know, above average risk. So understand that. And if you look at the, I'm trying to find the payouts here. Just know it yields about 3%. That's about what you'll get on a consistent basis. Now you're listening to Invest Talk. 888-99-CHART is our number. Chart 88992-4278. We have about 5 minutes left in the show, so if you're gonna call, you better do it ASAP. Now, we had the jobs report on Friday, and it was up about 211,000 jobs, which was better than expected. But if you kind of look underneath the hood, the quality of the jobs were, you know, to something to be desired, let's say that. The low-wage leisure and hospitality sector really led the way with 55,000 job gains. And if you look at the higher-wage goods-producing jobs, they slowed during the month. And you lump that on top of slower motor vehicle sales, construction spending contracting, and the PMI data in April and on the manufacturing side dropping. It shows an economy that still remains in very choppy to deceleration trajectory. Now, if you look at the trend, for leisure and hospitality. There was 55,000 jobs created last month in April in that space. In March, there were 9,000, okay? So it was up, but that's, once again, low-paying jobs. Now, the high-paying jobs, the construction sector, after having a good January and February of 34,000 and 54,000 jobs created in those 2 months respectively, March, there was only 1,000 jobs created in the construction sector and only 5,000 in April. So this is not boding well for the future of income growth, which is really most important, right? Because that's what you want. When you have job growth, you want the goal of having jobs growth is so that people have more money to spend. So you want that to be from high paying, high quality sectors, and that's really not happening. And if you look at private employment, year-over-year growth, the three-month average, it's now down to 1.7%. And this is the lowest that it's been since the recession. If you look at average hourly wage growth, it was picking up, right? In 2014, it was 2%. And end of last year, it got to 2.75%. And now it's dropped back to 2.65% over the last 3 months. And only 2.5% last month. And this isn't good. And this is on the back of baby boomers retiring, which tend to be higher paying, and being replaced by younger and cheaper workers. So that's part of it. And if you look at inflation year over year, now we had a big drop in inflation in 2015 and 16 because of oil prices. Now that gap is starting to shrink. The difference between consumer price index and the average hourly wage growth. And it's about even now, meaning that the average hourly wage growth is only keeping up with inflation. So there's no more juice left for consumers to go out there and spend after they get paid. Okay, so this is a really a low quality report, and it continues to show that the economy continues to decelerate. Now let's give one last word to a caller on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.
Hello, Steve and Justin. This is Mike from Louisville, Kentucky. I have a question, but first of all, I'm a longtime listener. I think your podcast is outstanding, and I listen to it regularly. I have a question about a core holding. AT&T, they have had some difficulties lately, and so my question is, what are your thoughts about holding it as a core holding, and if you already have it, whether you should get out, but if you should go into it, how long should you wait, and when should you have a buyback in? And if it's dropping and you think we ought to get out of it, at what point should we sell it? How's that for a complicated question? And I appreciate your time and energy, and I look forward to your answers.
I am not a fan of the wireless space right now when it comes to AT&T and Verizon. You know, T-Mobile has really been pushing on the industry, and they're doing well, but their valuation leaves something to be desired. So I'm not a huge fan of T-Mobile at these levels, but I do think overall the industry dynamics are really going to hurt AT&T and Verizon. And it's reducing their margins, reducing their cash flow, and that's why your stock has been so weak. And I knew this was going to happen. I just didn't know when these pressures were really going to accelerate. And I think they have over the past 6 to 9 months, maybe a year. And therefore, I think AT&T is not something I would hold in the near to medium term. And I think you'll have a chance to get at a much lower price. I don't know what that is until I understand how the industry dynamics shake out in the wireless space. So I would stay away from AT&T. Now our hour is up. Thank you for listening and joining in. I'm financial advisor and licensed realtor Justin Klein, chief executive officer of KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm. And for Steve Peasley and everyone at KPP, thank you for being with us. Let's plan on getting together tomorrow.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing.